Journey keyboardist Jonathan Cain on the line with us here. You've written a memoir. So tell us about how, first of all, you came about the idea that I need to tell my story.
I've been working on this book for a while, probably the last, 8 years, seriously. Ross Valerie kind of, double dared me, to dare you to write a book, because I would tell him all these stories about growing up in Chicago and, the funny stuff and the tragedy. And it was just quite a, I had a very good grip on the whole, on the memories came really easy for me. And I couldn't believe my memories served me so well. And I just thought it'd be interesting, especially reaching the Hall of Fame, to finally get it out and say, because I needed that opening bit, to really draw the reader in. And I, all my editors said, well, we're just not sure about the way you open this thing. We want to. And then when it happened, I stood there on stage. I knew that was going to be the turning point for the book. And I knew how I was going to tell it. It was very dramatic standing up there with them. The entire alumni journey, So there was a lot of, patterns, all my life I seemed to escape only to write the escape album.
Journey, truly, from the bottom of my heart, is my favorite band. I absolutely adore you guys. I've even adored the reboot, and I just think you guys are incredible. And of course, being in Detroit like we are, we must talk to you about the born and raised in South Detroit in the famous Don't Stop Believin'.
Quite a remarkable story. It really is.
Yeah, well, first of all, it was your dad's line, which I think is cool, when your dad says something to you that makes a song.
Anybody that loves that song will read the details and how every little last bit of it got written, and it was, a culmination of things that came to be, my father giving me the seed of it and the advice, the big advice on how I wrote it down and how I kept it with me is like sort of a prayer I'd read every night. Yeah, I got to keep believing my dad's mental stuff.
But of course, there is no South Detroit, though, right?
We knew that. of course, we went back to Joe Louis, I think it was, in 82. I know we had played Cobo Hall in 80 or 79, I think, for the departure tour. It was Captured.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Babies, I remember playing the Cobo Hall, and I remember watching them record Captured. You see this microphone over here? You see this microphone over here? it's still amazing memories. And then, of course, coming back, and then they told us, at the radio stations, there is no, and we laughed because, Steve liked to sing what sounded good.
Sure.
And we went through the West Detroit and East Detroit, and North Detroit, and we love Detroit, but we like South Detroit.
That's Canada, my friend.
We know that's Windsor. There is a little neighborhood though that I saw on the news.
Yes,
I can't remember the name of the town, but it is south of little southern Detroit. But you guys don't call it that.
Well, we call it actually when we do refer to it, Southwest Detroit. So you were close.
Just close.
We'll give you that.
Okay, because I saw it on the news. It was a little kind of a hippie town. It looked like there was an art festival there or something. And I said, aha, they lied to us.
Exactly. Vindication.
No, the thing you don't understand, they named the town after your guys' song.
Yeah.
That's probably it. No, I mean, in the end, Steve had a place in his heart for Detroit. And because I had born and raised in... And he looked at me, it's got to be Detroit, mm-hmm. And we just made this great record there. And they were so nice to us. He always loved coming there, And then the Babies, I got to say, were really well received there. We played Cobo Hall. We headlined with Mellencamp there,
mm-hmm.
in your town. And, of course, the softball games are legendary,
Yeah.
To play those softball
games. Yes.
Against the radio stations, and, they'd always lie about who won. And but those are good days. Those are really fun days.
My dad, you likely even played against him. His name is Dick Purton. He worked in this town for 40 years. And against him.
We have fond memories. I mean, I played at the Royal Oak. Come on.
Right.
The Royal Oak Theater, really. Babies and Cheap Trick.
Very cool.
That was a show. It was all girls. All girls. The whole audience was girls.
I want to get back to the memoir here. You say the book begins with a pivotal moment in your life, a day in 1987. What happened on that day that really sparks this book going off?
Well, you know, actually, the book begins, well, I can't give it all away, but, you know, it begins with one of the really high moments, and then it goes to a very low moment. You know, I wanted to do like a, I love that movie, Michael Clayton. It just kind of starts somewhere, and then it shifts back, and it shows you something that's like, whoa, what's going on? You know, and I wanted to do it in that fashion. So it was a big flashback. I mean, 30-year flashback, and we were in Anchorage, Alaska, of all places, it was the end of the Raytheon Radio Tour, and Steve Perry had announced he was leaving the band, and I was sitting with the fans probably at 1 o'clock in the morning in a bar with probably 25, 30 fans, and they all were going home bringing their CDs, because I said, I'm staying up and signing everything you got, you know, because I'm not going to be back here, and Steve Perry's not going to be back here, and this is the last Journey show you guys will have ever seen. He's done, you know. And it was hard. And then, of course, you know, the official, don't tell anybody, we're broken up. I'm just, I can't do this anymore. And having to hear that was tough, you know, your partner, you know, and we can't do any more than we've already done. And I can't do this anymore. It's just hard to swallow.
Well, I bet. I mean, this was your...
We had to accept it. Neil and I had to accept it. And, you know, we were like, wow, okay. Well, let us know, you know, your mind. And so we waited, you know. And, of course, we did other things. We did Bad English, and Neil did his band stuff. I did some solo albums. And it's interesting, the solo albums that I did ended up being in the audiobook. A lot of the music that I wrote fit the album, fit this audio book perfect, because I wanted to know who Jonathan Cain was. I knew who he was in Journey, but who is he without Journey? Mm-hmm. You know? What kind of writer is he, you know, and I really sort of went down kind of a Springsteen road and really laid out my life, you know, in an album called Back to the Innocence, and built a studio, you know, and I didn't know why I built this big studio. It was crazy out right next to my house out on the hill. Nothing would grow, and I'll put the studio there. So it was like a compound right next to the house. And I had my kids, you know, my first daughter came, and what a blessing to be there with her instead of on the road, you know. So God had a plan all the way, you know, and that studio would be the studio that Neil and I would put Journey back together again.
Wow, and I understand Steve Perry was not so happy about that.
He was not.
Yeah, and I know also in the book you outline how you really had major doubts about hiring a Steve Perry replacement, namely Arnell.
Well, it was kind of like a challenge, you know, and I explained to him my feelings, you know, and I said, there are going to be challenges here because you don't know the culture, you know, you haven't ever been, it was the first time he's ever been to the States. It was a very big leap.
Yeah, you guys found him in the Philippines by YouTube, basically.
Yeah, well, it was Neil that found him, you know, Neil found him, and I just went, he had a YouTube of Faithfully that somebody had posted, one of his friends. From the House of Blues there, or the Hard Rock, I think it was. And I loved his voice, but I said, I don't know, how's this going to work? You know, the fans, were American band. Are they going to accept this, you know? I think he's a great singer, but are they going to accept that? And is he going to be able to adjust, you know, to our culture? I had questions. I didn't have the doubts. Once I met him and found out what a man of, you know, he's a man of faith. He loves God. He loves his family. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a very solid guy, you know. I knew he could do it, but I knew he had to listen and take our guidance, you know, and he did. And I was very proud of the way he turned from a singer into a rock star. I saw him do that in a matter of a year, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember the first gig, you know, he wanted to go home.
Really?
Yeah, he said, can I go home now?
Well, you guys are a handful, I imagine.
Well, yeah. Well, we put him on a stage in Chile in front of 15,000 people being recorded, televised. Over 20 million people watched him.
Wow.
And we, you know, he was like, that was his first gig. His first big gig was in Chile, playing in a stadium for 15,000. You know, it was like this crazy, they call it Viña del Mar. And it was funny because they all loved him.
Yeah.
They were, I mean, they like, he was already an icon, pasta, they were at the airport ready to greet him. I mean, he got like rock star royal treatment, and we were like, wow.
You guys were like second class, right?
No, pretty much. And, yeah. And, you know, when as we went through the tour, we realized that these Filipinos were all so proud of him, you know, and we gained a whole new audience, you know.
Yeah.
And I just thought, you know, the fans, this is a different world we live in today, you know, and I think the idea that we would pick somebody from such a faraway place and that had such a tough childhood, you know, who else should be singing Don't Stop Believing But Arnell?
No, you're not kidding. And and the voice,
and,
I mean,
his wife, his mom died when he was very young, and, you know, he was homeless, and then he lost his voice, and then he found it again. They told him he'd never sing again, but he proved them wrong, and he came back from the dead and supported all of his family, his brothers and his father, and now he's like a hometown hero, you know, in Manila. He's deserving of this position. He's willing to take it on, and I sent him to my voice teacher, you know, and who used to teach Perry, you know, work with Perry, and he said, "You found your guy."
Well, can he make me sound like Steve Perry? Because it's pretty remarkable how much.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think so either.
That's got to be a God-given thing.
Yeah, I think so.
And Arnell really is a God-given thing. I mean, and Oprah, when we went on the show, it was like divine intervention, you know.
Yeah, that's
she
great.
Declared, you know, so.
Open Arms and Faithfully. Just incredible, incredible songs. And I was reading that Neil wasn't thrilled initially with these songs. I can't imagine, but take us back. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, when I got to the band, it was Perry. I went over to Perry's house to work on a couple of songs, and he said, "Man, I really want to do some ballads, you know. I want to do a solo album with ballads." And I said, "Why? You have Journey, you have this crowd. They would have loved to hear you sing a ballad, you know." And he said, "Well, do you have any?" And I said, I got
one. Yeah, give me a minute.
John Wade hated this song, but here it is. It's called Open Arms. And so I had my Wurlitzer piano in the car. Of course I did. And, you know, went and dragged in this big little electric piano with the screw-in legs, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Those Wurlitzer deals. And I played it for him, you know. And he's like, "Oh, God, we got to finish that."
Yeah.
I said, "Really?" I want to sing that, you know. And, man, that afternoon, we, you know, I think I took it up four whole steps because I sang it in A and he sang it in D.
Yeah.
I was like, "D? Yeah, that's where it sits for your voice." You
yeah,
know?
I can take it down to D, not up.
Right.
Being a real musician, I could play it in any key, you know. But anyway, I drove away from his house saying, "Wait till the world hears this."
Yeah.
I mean, you guys, Journey ended up being one of the premier power ballad bands of all time. I mean, you can't be a power ballad band without power ballads.
It turned out we were onto something. It turned out he was onto something. And with that voice of his, why not?
Yeah. You
know?
And really, we had it, you know, Neil actually, you know, had his trepidations about the song. We brought it into rehearsal. They all looked at us like he had a screw loose, you know. And Perry said, no, this is going to be great. You guys, it's going to be orchestra. It'll be like a symphonic thing. You know, it's going to soar in the halls. He said, when we played in a big place, this thing's going to come alive. It'll be like Neil Diamond, you know. Yeah, it could be like Neil Diamond, but better, you know. And so I got to give credit to Neil for seeing that, you know, for going along with us. And you know, even though he was, you know, kind of, even when we recorded, he was dead against it, you know. And the manager, even Herbie, said, "Oh, it's got to stay. This is pretty lovely, man. It's listen to the guy who's singing it. Listen to that voice in this song." And that, I think, what Neil had to give Perry was, there's nobody on the planet could sing that song like him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that's rare. When you have something that rare, that voice is one of a kind.
Mm-hmm.
And that song and that voice was just a fit. You know, and it just goes to show you that, you know, one singer, you know, it's not his cup of tea because they all have their instincts about what is good, you know, what is good for them. And that's one thing I gotta give them credit for is they both knew what they needed, you know, like a quarterback knows what he needs. He knows a good play when he sees one.
Absolutely.
You know? That song was not even meant to be. It was a request by the producer. We had not even rehearsed that song. Again, do you have a ballad? Of course I do, you know. But there's another interesting part to that, that Steve had wanted it for a solo album. He was making that Foolish Heart record, and I said no.
Yeah, we want it for Journey.
And I took, no, I want it for Journey. And our producer, Mike Stone, said, I need a ballad for this record. I know you have one. Bring it in tomorrow. And I said, well, Mike, there's going to be some contention over it. And he said, I don't care. We're cutting it. And that's what we did.
Great
Three
song.
3 days later, there was Faithfully.
Love it.
So, Jonathan Cain, when are we going to see you guys in Detroit next?
July 13th.
Yeah, see, I knew Joey would know the answer to that.
Comerica Park.
Coming. Yeah, we're going to be playing out there in the park. It's going to be pretty exciting. We have a couple of baseball fields we're playing in, Fenway in Boston, and we're playing in Wrigley.
Yeah, I'd say you'd have to play Wrigley, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's going to be epic. I mean, I can think about that Fogerty song. Look at me, Coach. I'm in center.
Yes.
But I will really be playing in center field, you know. No, I would go as a kid. I used to go to the games when I was 5 years old. My aunt, you know, she was a huge Cubs fan. So, but I love the Tigers too. Rocky Colavito, come on. I remember him as a kid. I had his baseball card. He was a stud. So yeah, we're excited about this tour. Def Leppard sounds great. They're, you know, we're co-headlining. They open up and we open up and. You know, you can get the book on actually at the merch stand.
All right.
Oh, good.
People that don't want to go to Amazon or, you know, I've got them. I signed a bunch of them, and we're trying to get it on the bestsellers list. But you know, it's music books are hard. Books are hard anyway.
Too. Oh yeah,
for sure.
But going on that book tour was like grueling.
It's worse than touring as a rock star, isn't it?
No, it was way harder.
Yeah.
They about killed me, you know. But I really have enjoyed writing this thing and telling the stories. And, you know, I've been asked so many times, like, what happened to Steve Perry? I'm like, I'm going to finally just tell the people.
That's in the book.
This is what I saw. This is what I saw. This is what I heard. You know, he'll write his own book. Neil actually liked the book. Can you believe it? And I was so thrilled that, you know, he got it.
Good.
And I thought it was a worthy story, you know, and out of the ashes, something new was born, you know, and, I had a terrible tragedy and, I had to get through and I decided to go to another direction. My father, of course, it's a love story. It'll make a great Father's Day present, really. This book really lifts up the idea that a dad can change and shape and speak into his son's life.
All right, my dad would like to hear that message.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wrote a song for Father's Day called My Dad Matters.
Oh, you know? Cool.
And he does matter. And, you know, he's I got his last name. His blood runs through my veins. It's like, this is it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's kind of missing in our family structure today is the respect and the honor that the father should get and should also, you know, behave in that fashion as well. You know, you got to earn that. You know, you can't, deadbeat dads don't deserve anything. I don't think, but the ones that are, you know, walking it out and doing the thing and, you know, providing, I see a lot of dads come to me and say, you know, I can't even talk to my kid. Mm-hmm. You know? And I said, well, it's a problem, you know? And my dad led the charge. He could have said, John, you know, this music thing's not going to get you anywhere. Why don't you just go to college and study something else, you know?
Yeah. I think my dad told me that.
Yeah, right? But not my dad. My dad said, no, you're going to play in front of 10,000 people or not. You're going to be huge.
Wow. Yeah.
And you're a rock star and I'm not. See how it worked out?
Yeah, right. Hey, you're still a songwriter, Steven.
I mean, so I hope everybody gets a dad like me, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like mine. You know, Lenny, who's passed on, and my mom and dad are both gone now. But I wanted to leave a legacy for my kids. And, you know, and anybody that has a dream, that I'm living proof that it's possible. If you can dream it, you can do it.
Yeah,
don't
that.
Stop Believing, the man, the band, and the song that inspired generations. It's a book from Journey keyboardist Jonathan Cain.
Well, keep up the great work. We love to listen. Well, we play your music a lot here.
Thank you so much, guys.
Well, I hope to see you in Nashville. I have a place in Nashville, and I go down there to write and record, so I'll have to stop by and say hi sometime.
Well, yeah, you got to see our studio. We've got Addiction Sound. It's unbelievable. It's there in the Berry Hill area.
All right, cool.
You can look up Addiction Sound, and my friend David will take care of you. You know, I'm there. I'm going to go finish my worship album. I've got my third one under my belt now.
Cool. Awesome. Thank you. Thank
Jonathan,
you, Jonathan,
thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay.
Thank you, guys.
All right.
Okay, you have a good day.
You
bye-bye.
Too. Bye-bye.